You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day, as it's always going to be for the rest of the summer.
Pretty much. We do get clouds occasionally here in the summer, but not very often. If you buy the Redwood Barn Nursery Garden Calendar, we have a little box up in the left-hand corner of each month that tells you the number of cloudy days each month, the average rainfall, the typical highs, and so on. Let me go ahead and tell you, I'm going to open up my calendar here, and we're looking at the month of June, right?
We are.
Number of cloudy days, 2.4.
That's our average.
Average in June. 2.4 out of 30 are cloudy. The average high in June is 87. The average low is 58. The record high in June was 115. I remember that. The record low was 41. No idea when that was. And our average rainfall in the month of June is 0.2 inches. Number of cloudy days in July, 1. Number of cloudy days in August, 1.3. So it's a fairly sunny place that we live here. And the only question is whether our high temperatures are going to be comfortable or uncomfortable, suitable for plant growth or not. And today's high is going to be, let's see, 93 degrees as Lois and I are preparing the show for broadcast on June 4th. It is going to broadcast on the 5th. Tonight's low will be 56 degrees, pretty typical there. Thursday will be 86 degrees and sunny. Thursday night, 54, Friday, 89 and sunny all the way through. I don't need to say that part again. Friday night, clear, 56 degrees, Saturday, 93 degrees, Saturday night, 57, Sunday, 91 and so forth. Pretty much the same right on into next week. Highs around 91 to 92 at the most, lows in the mid 50s, which is pretty ideal gardening weather. KDRT is community radio. It's public radio. That means we rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And the folks that run that place send us public service announcements every now and then that they would like for us to read, events that KDRT is involved in, things like that. And Lois, I think you have one of those.
I have six of them, but it's all same organization. They just give us options as to what we want to say.
Right.
And it's all supposed to start with, this hour of KDRT programming is underwritten by the Davis Live Music Collective. And that is an organization here in town which does the annual Davis Music Festival. And this is our 13th annual festival. It will be June 20th through 22nd. Ticket information and in schedules and all that stuff is at davismusicfest.com.
And we will be broadcasting, not Lois and I, but KDRT will be broadcasting from the Davis Music Fest when it occurs. We'll give you more information as we get closer to the date.
And there's going to be so many good acts out there that I can't even start to tell you all 35 artists.
All around the community, there will be music happening. So that's the Davis Music Fest coming up. What was the other one that they sent us?
Oh, but that one's over.
Okay. Okay, good. All right.
And then the other thing that I wanted to tell you about is that we have wonderful programming here in the station. And the folks in town who do it are just amazing, award-winning, know everybody in the world. Craig Musburger is one of those. He goes by Rocky, and he is going to have another fantastic guest, Lori Lewis. Now, Don, you know about Lori Lewis, the queen of California bluegrass, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Know who she is? Yep.
Yep, and she's going to be on. So that's coming up on Friday the 6th. That's the
Rocky's program is called the Yolo County Breakdown, and that is Fridays at 10 to 11 a.m., and it replays 1, 2, 3 times during the week. And Rocky Outcrop, as he goes by, likes to play bluegrass, newgrass, and beyond. From Bill Monroe to Billy Strings, the Yolo County Breakdown is a journey through acoustic string music ranging from the traditional to the cutting edge. I love this quote on his page. As Duke Ellington wrote, there are simply two kinds of music. Good music and the other kind. Rocky likes the good kind. So you can listen to the Yolo County Breakdown. And Rocky has been bringing in amazing guests to interview in the studio as well as playing their music. So that's the Yolo County Breakdown, Fridays at 10 a.m.
I wonder if we could take that saying, that sentence, and somehow morph it a little bit into a gardening quote.
Sure. Also, I want to mention you had commented that we're getting close to harvest season. And you know, one of the questions that Lois often asks me at the start of the show is, what are you harvesting right now? And first, I will say I'm harvesting Flavor Delight apriums right now, which is an aprium. What's an aprium? I've now had to explain this to about 6 different people because I have a basket of them sitting on the counter at my nursery. It is, as the name suggests,
apricot and plum.
A cross between apricot and plum. It came out of the same breeding programs as the pluots, which people are more familiar with.
It's a plum and an apricot. Wait a minute.
Luther Burbank, at the beginning of the 20th century, managed to successfully hybridize apricots and plums. He was, of course, one of the best-known plant breeders in American history, and he did all kinds of interesting experimental stuff. And it's hard to cross between species. Plums and apricots are different species in the genus of Prunus, but he accomplished it, and the first results were mediocre, and he didn't really pursue that any further. But Floyd Zager, who was a UC Davis alumnus and developed his own breeding company, all of their products have been introduced and are carried by Dave Wilson Nursery. So the retail garden centers and hardware chains, hardware stores around the country buy from Dave Wilson in the bare root season. Floyd Zager took the pluot and the aprium concept and went with it and developed all of the well-known pluots, which are a plum apricot hybrid. And from the same basic parentage, but going in the other direction, several apriums, which are apricot plum hybrid. What's the difference? Well, pluots are considered to be about 3 parts plum to 1 part apricot, and they look like a plum. They have the texture and then just have that sweeter undertaste of an apricot. Apriums are about 3 parts apricot to 1 part plum, and they are sweeter, milder flavored. They're like an apricot with that, you know, more pronounced sweetness, but they have the crisper texture of a plum. Many apricots are very soft when they're ripe. Apriums have a firmer texture. Flavor Delight was the first one that came on the market. Mine is very reliable and consistent. It ripens in early June. It really ripens about June 7 to 10 or so, but I go by when the birds start eating them, and I start harvesting when the birds start eating them, which they started doing 3 days ago. So I go out there and I harvest as many as I can so that I can get them into the house before they enjoy all of them or one bite out of all of them. They are sitting on my counter. They have a great flavor, a great texture, and they're very consistent and reliable. So the Flavor Delight Aprium was the first that came on the market. That's the one I have. There's a new one called Cotton Candy, which is even sweeter, I'm told. Haven't tasted that one, but I have one planted. So I'll give you a report on that in a year or two. Apriums are some of the first stone fruit you can harvest.
So we're just beginning with these fruit trees coming in.
Yeah.
But at some point, you, dear listener, might find that your fruit tree is outstripping your stripping capability.
Yes. A good year on a plum can be several hundred fruit.
If you got more than you need, more than you can pick, more than your neighbors can come over and harvest for you, don't let it rot. Go to or call the Davis Harvest. And it's called harvestdavis.org, www.harvestdavis.org, if you want to go to their website. And Joe Schwartz is the person who schedules the picks. So call him, write to him, and get your information. This one does the Davis area and provides the fruit to the local Davis agencies, mostly Steak and the Yolo Food Bank and some local churches. Yep. There is one in Woodland, Don. You said, where is that?
Well, let's back up here. The official name of the group you're referring to is Community Harvest of Davis. Community Harvest of Davis. And yes, harvestdavis.org is the way to get there. And all you'll find there is an email and a phone number, which is really all you need. Just send them a note that says, my Santa Rosa plums are about to fall all over the ground, and they'll come out and they'll harvest them if they can. In Woodland, we did find, thanks to Cool Davis organization, they have a little post about Woodland Community Harvest. So I searched around to see if there's a similar thing in Dixon or Vacaville, and I'm sure there is, but I could not find one readily. Wherever you're listening, you probably have a food bank. You probably have an organization that would love to have fresh produce brought to them under certain conditions. Don't just show up and dump a bunch at them, but they can probably use your excess. You may have an organization like Community Harvest of Davis or Woodland Community Harvest. And the one in Woodland we found through the cooldavis.org website. It's not any particular difficulty finding it, but their link is, well, their email is wcharvest@yahoo.com. So wherever you're listening, if you've got a surplus, and if you've ever grown a stone fruit, you probably have a surplus. Wherever you're listening, if you have a surplus, there's probably an organization that would like it. But you got to check with them to see how to get it harvested and how to get it to them.
And I'm going to put this email for the Davis folks, info@harvestdavis.org. Yeah. By the way, we found something interesting when we tried to go to their website. If you don't put the three W's and a period in front of it, it doesn't show up.
Yeah. So giving you the name Community Harvest of Davis and Woodland Community Harvest gets you started locally. Yolo Food Bank can always use donations, and they make amazing use of these things. And I'm sort of joking about the volume, but I have a Santa Rosa plum. I think you have a Santa Rosa. My estimate is that my Santa Rosa plum is going to have 300 to 500 fruit on it. And the thing about Santa Rosa plum, it's a very nice plum. It's probably the most popular variety in California. When they ripen, they're all ripe. It's that weekend is the weekend you got to do something with them. It's very popular because it is a good pollinizer for other types of plums and all the pluots. It's an easy one to grow. It's consistent and reliable. It also produces a lot of fruit, and it doesn't hang on the tree. So if you're choosing a plum for your backyard, slight digression here, it's a great one, but there are plenty of others that hang better on the tree. If you want one that you can pick over several weeks, for example, Emerald Butte starts ripening in, I think it's the first week of August, and hangs all the way into September. Nubiana is another one that can hold for at least 3 or 4 weeks on the tree. So from a home garden standpoint, you might want to look for some that have better keeping quality on the tree so you can harvest over a longer period of time. But if you like to process, make jam, freeze, have a whole bunch of fruit early in the season, that's the other big advantage of Santa Rosa, it's a great one to have. But you're going to have more than you can possibly use, and probably more than you and most of your neighbors can make use of. So consider some of these food banks.
And those two trees that you mentioned about being good for homeowners, mm-hmm. Do they need a Santa Rosa to cross-pollinate with?
They do not. Now, this is really important. You're going out to buy a plum. The most important question you can ask before you wrap it up and take it home or put it in your car is, do I need a second kind of plum to go with this? Because for most Japanese plums, which is what we're talking about here, most of them, you have to have another type. And Santa Rosa is the preferred other type because it will act as a pollinizer for basically every other type of plum. Burgundy plum is another one that's a very good pollinizer for others. And it's a very good quality fruit as well. There are self-fruitful plums. At my nursery, we try to focus on those when I'm doing the bare root order for the winter, because not everyone has room for two plums. Not everyone has the use for the fruit production of two plums. They're heavy producing trees. So you may be looking for just one. Well, Santa Rosa is good. Burgundy is good, but the two that I mentioned, Nubiana, which is that dark, almost black plum you've seen in the grocery store with yellow flesh, very sweet, nice firm texture. That one hangs on the tree for 3 or 4 weeks. Emerald Butte is a greenish, brownish one that hangs on the tree for as much as 6 weeks. So you can actually just go out and pick them whenever you need them, rather than, oh my God, this is the weekend, we have to do the Santa Rosa plums, and we were thinking of going on vacation. That's what Lois deals with.
I know we're not going to delve deep into plums this time, but I do want to mention something that is confusing for people who are new to this. The fact that the Santa Rosa plum is starting to get ripe, they're probably going to be pickable the beginning of July, and these others are they're late in the fall. It doesn't matter for the blossoms.
Correct. They all bloom at the same time.
All at the same time. So all this cross-pollination stuff that we're talking about, don't worry about the fact that they harvest at different times.
Yeah.
They blossom together.
Yeah, if you want plums all summer, they all bloom together. Santa Rosa overlaps. The blooms have to be together or else you don't get cross-pollination. Well, if you plant four plums, you can get plums from June through September. And to me, I always say this repeatedly, plums are some of the easiest fruit trees to grow here in California. I know some of you are listening back east where you have the plum curculio, which is a nightmare pest, I'm told. We don't have that here. You don't have to spray plums for anything really ever. And you prune them if you want. If you don't, they'll get big and they'll fall apart, but it takes them a while to do that. So it's not like a peach where you absolutely have to prune them every year. You don't really care about fruit size all that much, so you don't really have to thin them. And not much goes wrong with plums here. So if you're looking for an easy backyard tree, plums and pluots are a great combination, but look for the need for cross-pollination. Are they self-fruitful? And if you're listening, of course, in coastal areas in Southern California, check the chilling hours. We got a million questions. Let's move on here. That was all community service conversation.
This other is every week I'm supposed to start our show with the questions. Don, are you starting any new seeds now?
Yes, I'm starting cucumbers. And because I want to continue to plant them, we'll get into a little discussion of succession planting. I'm starting squash, particularly winter squash. We're doing seed right now at our nursery in our greenhouse. It takes 3 days to germinate. It goes into a 4-inch pot 3 or 4 days later, and they're literally saleable 3 or 4 days after that. So people might wonder, why are we bothering to put seeds in pots to sell when it only takes, 10 days for them to become a saleable commodity? Why not just sell people a pack of seeds? And I can answer that very simply. Most people are scared of seeds. Most people are scared to plant things from seed. They don't have good results. They had a bad experience. They are, in my case, if I plant seeds out in the garden, I might as well just put up a sign, all you can eat buffet for the wildlife that I share my property with. When I plant out seedlings, I don't have that problem. So I understand, there's a lively discussion going on in the nursery Facebook group right now about why do you sell beans in six packs? Why does anybody buy six packs of corn? Don't they just plant the seed directly? And I said the same thing I just said here. You'll turn off gardeners if you tell them to plant things from seed. They'll have a bad experience. They'll think, I'm a bad gardener, and they'll give up. Whereas if you're transplanting out seedlings, they're just a little further along, a little bit of pest damage. A little pest damage on a 5-inch tall bean plant is fine. A little pest damage on a 2-inch tall bean seedling is lethal. So there's a big difference in likelihood of success when you go from transplants. And people are willing to pay extra money for that privilege. Right now, doing winter squash, pumpkins, cucumbers, summer squash continuing. Those are things we're doing from seed. We're also still planting zinnias from seed. They'll be plantable out in the garden in 2 to 3 weeks. We're doing cosmos, one of my favorite late summer flowers for the vegetable garden. I like to do it on the perimeter or periphery, take your pick, of the vegetable garden. And I'm also doing sunflowers, which I started, the first ones back in April, and they're 3 feet tall, and I'm continuing to plant out sunflowers. In this particular case, I'm growing the ones that are used for snacks. The one thing we're about to start a bunch of is pumpkins for pepitas, pumpkins for the seeds. There are varieties that are grown specially for that. They have hullless seeds, a hard word to say on the radio. Hull is the papery coating on the pumpkin seed. Hullless pumpkin seeds don't have that papery coating. They're more tender. So there are varieties of pumpkins, and they have funny names like Godiva or baby, like Lady Godiva, who went naked on the horse, right? So it's a naked seed. Okay, baby bear. There's a couple others that we're doing. These are not jack-o'-lantern pumpkins. These are not pie pumpkins. They are grown specially for the rather large, hullless, and very tender seeds. And we're going to be planting a bunch of those on our farm, but also for sale. And this is something that you can plant all through the month of June. Pumpkins for jack-o'-lantern trade are generally planted about July 1. So you have the whole month of June here in the Sacramento Valley, most parts of, well, certainly interior Southern California, coastal zones, and a lot of other places people are listening. You can go ahead and plant pumpkins all the way through this month. And that also goes for winter squash, which are very similar to pumpkins. And you can plant summer squash and cucumbers all the way into the middle of the summer. A summer squash, like a zucchini, planted anytime in June will be producing zucchini for you 30 to 45 days later. So you can just do a little math on your calendar and figure out how late you can plant those. I did mention succession planting. I do recommend successive plantings of cucumbers because each cucumber plant grows vigorously, sets, and then tends to peak out after a certain number of weeks. And so if you want a steady crop of cucumbers, planting a new plant or two or three or four every 2 to 4 weeks will give you a longer harvest. Same thing goes with bush beans. Same thing goes with corn. And it can work with summer squash as well. You can continue planting those things all the way into early July for crops later and later in the season. So the successive planting is really actually something that more gardeners should look at because I think it's a better way to even out your harvest. Bush beans, for example, will produce X number of weeks from planting and then they're done. That's great. You cut them down, the roots break down, benefit the soil, and you've got the harvest from those plants. And if you planted some more 3 or 4 weeks later, you'll be getting those a couple weeks afterward. So my experience is that successive plantings is better, particularly for people who are just feeding maybe a small family. If you're really into freezing and canning and whatnot, go for an all-at-once crop of beans or whatever and put them by, as my grandmother used to say. But for most of us, we're just going out there for a sampling for dinner, and we want to be able to pick that. Let's say anytime from July through September, you achieve that with successive plantings.
I have a question about cucumbers. Do we have a cucumber question coming up later in the show?
I think no.
I'll ask it now then.
Okay.
When you plant a cucumber and it grows and it sets little cucumbers, they're very cute. And then they grow up and then you get ready.
They go off to college and they get a degree and they go out and get a job. Yeah.
The job is to be tasty.
Yes. So
do cucumbers on one plant all get done at the same time, or is it however long after the cucumber set? In other words,
no, a cucumber is
one in 20 days.
You get a cucumber or two every day for a few weeks is what happens on the average producing cucumber. It's a vine. The vine needs to keep growing in order to sustain the fruit that has formed back behind it. And each flower forms successively along the vine. And just my experience has been that it's about a 4 to 6 week harvest from an individual plant, on which time you get anywhere from 6 to 12 cucumbers, depending on the variety. Older types were more all at once, kind of like you're describing. You know, they come on, you pick them, then you get a whole bunch. You don't know what to do with them all. And they'll always tell you, keep them harvested or the plant will stop producing, which is true. So you're looking up relish recipes and figuring out what to do with all this surplus all at once. Better to have one plant producing, a couple now, and a couple more each few days. And then as it plays out and finishes, you have the one you planted 3 or 4 weeks later coming into production. So it's a vine that continues to produce, but only in a limited way. Generally speaking, each one will peak out after about, let's say, 6 weeks of harvest has been my experience. Part of it is that things are catching up with the vine. This is true of everything in cucurbitaceae, pumpkins, squash, melons. It's a vine. It's growing vigorously. The new growth is sustaining the old fruit that's forming back there. And if it's a big pumpkin, for example, that fruit is way back there. It's set in June or July, and you're counting on all those new leaves that are forming to keep it going, growing, getting bigger, and get it to harvest. And as anyone who's grown pumpkins or vigorous vine-like members of cucurbitaceae knows, the older leaves start to decline. You get mildew on them, you get mites, you get white flies, you get things affecting the older leaves. Don't worry too much about that, although you can wash them off very vigorously and manage them to some degree that way. As long as new growth is coming and you have healthy new leaves on the plant, you're still sustaining those larger fruited types like pumpkins and winter squash and so forth. Cucumbers, it's all compressed, you know. You're still counting on that new growth to come on and sustain those older cucumbers that are forming, but you're also harvesting them way sooner than you do pumpkins and squash and melons and things like that. But it's important not to lose the growing point and to have enough healthy new growth coming to sustain those older fruit that have formed.
Okay, back to cucumbers. I still have questions, Don. What is the difference between a ripe and an unripe cucumber? Because I mean, I see people pick little ones that they're going to pickle.
No cucumbers that we eat are ripe. We don't let them ripen. It's like they're always eaten unripe.
Okay, so does it matter? I mean, you just wait till they're a certain size to pick them, or you just
your choice depends on the variety. Some of them, now this is the thing: the seeds get bigger and the interiors get watery as cucumbers mature, unless you do the burpless types, because they don't have seeds or they have very reduced seeds. So one of the reasons I'm a big fan of what we in America call the burpless cucumbers, they may be labeled English forcing cucumbers. They may be labeled burpless because of the lack of seeds. Some people have trouble digesting cucumber seeds. They may be labeled Japanese. Many of the best known varieties come from Japan. These were originally bred as greenhouse cucumbers. They were bred for forcing and for sale at premium prices. They're very thin skinned. They're the type where you can eat the skin. Technically, folks, you can eat any cucumber skin, but these are thin enough that people don't object to it. They have no bitterness to them. And even if they get surprisingly big, they don't develop large watery areas in the middle. And they don't develop large seeds. So they're very sweet and they can be harvested surprisingly big. But even still, you're harvesting them well before they would technically be ripe. We don't let them ripen in the sense that a pumpkin does or a winter squash does. We pick them and use them green. I think that for most home gardeners, these new modern burpless type cucumbers are your best bet. Because even if they've gotten surprisingly large, they're still usable. My second choice is Persian cucumbers. You've seen those little baby cucumbers in bags that are the size, 4 inches long. Those are typically Persian cucumbers that have been picked very small. If you let them get big, they get big rapidly and they get large seeds and they get large watery cavities in the middle. So they're undesirable when they're past a certain size, but they're very tender and very sweet and people have really developed a taste for them. Those are the two that I do the most, burpless and Persian. Third one I always plant is lemon cucumber because I really like it. It's an old heirloom variety. It has great flavor, but it's kind of a hassle because it's round, so it's hard to peel. And the biggest mistake people make with lemon cucumber, because of the name, is they wait to harvest them until they're yellow, at which point they're overripe. Pick them green. They're much better green than they are yellow. The group I never bother with anymore, regular old green cucumbers, because in my experience here, we have a heat wave of any kind. I mean, temperatures even in the upper 90s, which isn't technically a heat wave by our standards. The fruit is bitter and it's very frustrating. It has, as long as you're watering correctly, they're growing fine, you harvest them and they're bitter. Bear in mind, if you happen to have a bitter cucumber in front of you, the bitterness is concentrated in the stem end. The flower end tends not to be as bitter. So just keep trimming away from the stem as you're using it and touch it to your tongue. You'll know right away if it's bitter. And usually the first inch or two is where the bitterness is concentrated. And if you peel a little deeper and get a little more of the white flesh from underneath the skin, you'll tend to remove the bitterness as well. But why bother? Just grow a regular burpless cucumber or a Persian cucumber or both and plant them successively as the summer goes along.
Well, let's move on. There's one question I'm supposed to ask you every week. Do you have any special tips on watering this week? It's only going to be in the 90s. It should be a normal week.
Yeah, most of our vegetables have successfully rooted down to the drip line irrigation watering pattern. So this is a pattern I go through. That was a very clumsy sentence, so I'm going to start over. Okay. I start by planting vegetables and I water them by hand. There is a drip line nearby and each plant has at least one emitter depending on what it is. And I do run the drip line every few days to give a couple gallons of water for the soil below and beyond the root system of the little vegetable plant. But I hand water them. I check daily and water as needed. Where have I heard that before? I check daily. Lois is wearing her shirt that says check daily, water is needed. One of our listeners sent that to us and it is, she's wearing it as we speak. They haven't needed water every day, but during that dry wind they did. During the 100 degree days, we had 2 days just over 100 degrees just a few days ago, they did need water each day. So I hand water the plant because still a lot of the roots are in the nursery soil. And then every couple of days I run the drip system. Well, at this point, first week of June, I no longer have to hand water the seedlings, except the ones I put in day before yesterday. I'm running the drip system every couple of days, and I'm making sure each plant gets at least a gallon of water when I run the system, so that I'm watering not just the root zone of the, you know, the soil that was put in, but also past it out and down. This principle applies to trees, shrubs, anything you're planting. Water beyond the existing root zone so the roots can grow into moist soil, because as we love to say, is one of our favorite aphorisms here, roots will not grow into dry soil. So I have managed to shift over from hand watering each little seedling every day or so to everything is pretty much on the drip line, except things that I'm still putting in. So I'm now at the point where I just keep a water can out there full of water. I fill it with water right before I leave the garden. So in the morning, if I go out there, the two plants that I just planted that need water, I can hand water them. I don't have to drag a hose all the way down there. Keeping in mind, folks, I have a very long vegetable garden. So I've got like 300 feet of hose all hooked up and I have to lock way down there to turn on the hose. And so if I'm watering 50 plants, yeah, no problem. But if it's just two, I keep a water can out there. I think a watering can is an extremely important gardening tool.
I want to make a comment for listeners who might be misinterpreting something that Don and I have said in the past. We've been talking about watering the soil outside the original root ball. Mm-hmm. And that's very useful because then the roots can go on out. You also have to water the root ball.
Yes, that's the point. Yes. So that's a summary. I'm hand watering the root ball and drip watering the soil around it. And at some point I can tell just from experience when the roots have made the connection from the nursery soil to the drip soil. That was that first garbled sentence I was attempting to put out there was basically saying they've gotten from the hand watered zone to the drip watered zone. That's what I was trying to say. There we go. And almost all of them have achieved that now. So all I have to do now is walk out there, decide whether or not to turn on the drip line and do so. And it's because I have those little handy timers on there. I just go, all right, 45 minutes and walk away, depending on what I'm doing. Whereas until about the last couple of days, it was, okay, those 12 plants need to be hand watered. Those over there are fine. So, you know, you have that intermediate period. Pretty much now in June, you should be able to drip water. But I'm seeing at my nursery and from pictures sent to me about problems, constant problems with vegetable gardens that are not establishing well because of the drip system is really what it boils down to, because of how the drip system is being used most commonly. And my go-to answer at this point is go out there, turn the thing on, walk away for a couple hours. I mean, really hydrate the whole thing. No, that little plant doesn't need that. Your whole garden bed needs that so the roots can grow out. Many of them are just watering the nursery soil still, that little zone around the roots. We've talked about this many times, but we started the year with low soil moisture. We haven't had measurable rainfall since early March, is my recollection. We had a long period in April and May where it was pretty cool. We didn't have a lot of hot weather in April and May. We were average to below average a lot of the time. And then suddenly we got to normally high temperatures and dry north wind and a couple hundred degree days, and plants are showing sudden stress. A big issue is that people simply are starting with dry soil. And so people who know what they're doing, who are normally would be watering correctly, they're not getting the results they normally would have because we don't have the soil moisture from the winter rains that we would normally have down there. So you got to pretend that you're providing some of that every now and then. Every now and then through the summer, you should run your system, whatever it is, one whole another cycle. That seems to be an easy thing for people to figure out. Or turn it on by hand for a couple hours while you're home to watch how it hydrates the soil and so forth. And those of you with raised planter beds already know that the water goes straight down in those raised planter beds. And you need to check your system and make sure it's hydrating correctly. I got a picture of one where it was a whole series of wet dots. I could tell exactly what was happening. They were only running it for 20 or 30 minutes. And so that's part of the problem. But they had emitters a foot or so apart. So they had wet spots a foot or so apart. And in between were dry spots. The plants can't grow into dry spots. So you need to periodically hydrate the whole zone. We've said this so many times, I think we can move on to another topic. Unless you had a question.
T-shirt, Don. Hydrate the whole zone.
There you go. Check daily. Water is needed. Hydrate the whole zone periodically. That'll be our next T-shirt.
So in the questions that he sent me, and he sent me a bunch of questions that customers had as they'd come into his shop and he talked to them. And one was this discussion about cucumbers, which we're not going to go into because we did that. Yep. But it says, it gave me the chance to say that this variety is gynaecious parthenogenic type.
What?
is that?
Gynecias and Parthenocarpic. Gynecias means predominantly, if not entirely, female flowers. Parthenocarpic means it sets fruit without pollination. So these were bred originally for greenhouse production. And when you're doing cucumbers in a greenhouse, one of your problems is you'd have to have bees in there to go from the male flowers to the female flowers, and bees in a greenhouse, well, a little scary. I remember some studies on using bumblebees for that purpose, and it only took one or two bumblebees in a greenhouse to take care of pollination. A cucumber plant has male and female flowers. In most cucumbers, and this is true of squash, melons and pumpkins and everything in that family, when you see the female flower, the little fruit is already at the base. You can see the little baby cucumber there. You can see the little baby pumpkin, the little baby squash, even before it's pollinated. And if it doesn't pollinate, that just yellows and falls off. A lot of times, the first questions we get are, my squash, my cucumber is flowering like crazy, and I don't see any cucumbers or squash. Those are male flowers. And the male flowers do outnumber the female flowers, especially early in the season. Well, greenhouse growers it's a high cost operation. These are being grown in the Netherlands, Canada, places where greenhouses are expensive to operate. So it wasn't surprising that when someone came up with a predominantly female flowered cucumber, gynecias, that it would be a big seller for them because you get more cucumbers per square foot, which would be fine, except that you would have to provide another type of cucumber with the male flowers, just like if you're growing seedless watermelons, which would just be wasting space as far as the grower is concerned. But it had to be in there to get the male flowers, and you had to get the bees in there, or you have to take a camel's hair brush and bee the bee yourself, which is fairly tedious, until they found that some were parthenocarpic, which is the characteristic of setting fruit without pollination. Fruit that sets parthenocarpically doesn't have seeds. Hey, there's a big advantage in cucumbers right there. So varieties that were predominantly female flowers that set fruit without pollination with no seeds took over the market, to put it mildly. Greenhouse growers could make way more money per square foot. But this is a big advantage for home gardeners as well, that you can find these and you can grow them and you'll get at least double the production from them. And they will have little tiny seeds, if at all. So even if you let them get half again bigger than you think is appropriate, you'll find they're still perfectly good and perfectly usable, and you get more fruit per plant. So lots of advantages there. The drawback, they're about $2 to $3 a seed. So these are F1 hybrids that are not cheap. I buy them every year. I buy a packet of seeds for, you know, $12 for six seeds. And so you're not going to find these in garden centers typically because of that cost per seed. It's the kind of thing you need to seek out yourself to grow from seed. Good news, you still got time. So good question. Very timely, Lois.
Bad news is that you can't save seed from one year to the next.
There's no seed to save. That's correct. It's like seedless watermelons. Sir, how do they grow seedless watermelons if they don't produce seeds? Well, they have two parent lines and they cross them. They create a sterile, anyway, it's like a mule.
Don, he usually gives me these things with questions that people have had. Well, this one, it was one customer who had a lot of questions or requests or whatever you would call them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to go through them one at a time.
Yep.
They wanted blossom. They had blossom end rot on their tomatoes, the Roma tomatoes, and they were looking for calcium.
Yeah, so this is a common one. A few weeks back, I made a note that I should mark my calendar because the weather we were having was going to lead to blossom end rot 7 weeks out. Well, lo and behold, here came in a person 7 weeks later looking for product for blossom end rot. Roma tomatoes, I asked, I'll say, does it happen to be Roma? Yeah. Yeah, because Roma is, like, as we say, the canary in the coal mine for blossom end rot. It gets it no matter what. And the first fruit will have blossom end rot. Just pick them off, throw them away. The next ones will be fine. As we've told you all many times, deficiency of calcium in the soil, in the plant, is not the cause of blossom end rot, but it was thought to be for years and years and years. So the horticulture industry has always sold these calcium products, Folical, things like that. Or people will tell you apply gypsum because that's calcium sulfate. If you've ever lived in Davis or Woodland, you've seen this white residue that we get on the soil from the times when we're using well water here. That's calcium. We have no shortage of calcium in our water. There's also borax in there. That's a common constituent of water in well water areas. Even though we've gone off of the wells primarily, we still use well water 10, 20, 30% of the time. There's loads of calcium. We have no deficiency of calcium in the soil. It's not a deficiency of calcium in the plant either. That was widely believed for a long time, but that was the impetus for the sales of the calcium sprays like Folical, which is a liquid form of calcium you can spray on plants. They'll absorb it, at least in theory, through their stomata, and you'll get calcium into the plant. All that research on calcium deficiency was misdirected. It is not the cause of blossom end rot. It's not a deficiency in the plant. It's not a deficiency in the soil. It simply is caused by cold temperatures and excessive soil moisture, at least correlates with cold temperatures and excessive soil moisture affecting the uptake of positive ions, appears to be the direct mechanism. So they can induce it by the use of ammonia fertilizer, which is a positive ion. In hydroponic experiments, they manipulated potassium, which is a positive ion, and induced blossom end rot, and then corrected it. It's not a deficiency of potassium. It's not a deficiency of ammonia. It's simply the effect on the ion atmosphere in the around the roots, I guess is the best way to put it, and lack of mobility within the plant. It just happens, and it's cold temperature related and watering related. So there is no correction for blossom end rot except to water deeply, water correctly, and be patient because the next crop will be along just fine, and you just generally don't have blossom end rot after the first few fruit that show that problem. And certain varieties are famous for it. Roma is famous for it. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with planting Roma. Just be aware you're likely to get blossom end rot on the first fruit. So that was the first one.
All right. So having gone through this massive explanation.
I keep it short, but yeah.
How calcium is not the problem, but it was a cold temperature when the fruit was created. And the person continued to say, well, the internet has lots of articles that say calcium's the problem.
Yes, the internet is not a good source of horticultural information. Just for fun, I opened up an AI thing on horticulture and typed in, what is the cause of blossom end rot? What do you think AI told me?
Calcium.
Yeah, because that's what they're going to find. that's what AI is going to find if their algorithm goes onto the internet and finds all the information. All the misinformation will be in there. So AI is just going to make the misinformation happen faster.
And the expectation that is what the problem was printed in serious articles.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Those articles have never been updated. And so you can get things from the 30s telling you stuff that we know isn't true.
Mm-hmm. Now we know because science changes. I mean, people have done more elaborate studies to determine what exactly is going on. And the answer is that calcium is not the problem. Anyway, that was the first one. But yes, going on the internet to look for gardening information is like asking for medical advice at a cocktail party. You should, you know, take it with a grain of salt. Next.
Or a lot of alcohol. So the next one was their Satsuma mandarins, which they picked in late winter, weren't flavorful. So they were looking for fertilizer to make their Satsumas more flavorful.
So any connection between fertilizer and fruit quality is pretty tenuous. I do get this question. My tomatoes weren't sweet, so should I have fed them with something? Actually, what I looked at was Satsuma mandarins picked in late winter. That's late in the season for Satsuma mandarins. And they hang on the tree, but they get sweeter and milder as the season goes along. This is true of most citrus. There's a peak of the balance between acidity and sugar, and every variety has its own perfect combination of those things. And that's often based on consumer preferences, consumer expectations as to what is ideal. But Satsuma mandarins are picked in November, up when you're slightly uphill, and they get the chilling that causes higher sugar content and reduced acidity. But that perfect balance of those two happens in the Rockland, Loomis area here in the Sacramento area in November. So they can get theirs to the market by Thanksgiving. Mine are perfect at Christmas time, really good going into January. And then they hang on the tree, and some of them fall. A lot of them fall, but a lot of them hang on the tree. There's still some out there right now hanging on the tree. They're perfectly good. They're just sweet. There's no depth to the flavor. They've lost the acidity. And so the sugar content may actually increase, and some people might like that, but they'll taste milder and less interesting. They won't meet our expectation. And with citrus, this is absolutely the case. There are consumer expectations for particular varieties. We expect grapefruit to have a little bitterness. That's part of the flavor. Most people don't call it that, but they expect that. We expect a balance of tart to sweet in mandarins, that in particular. Oranges in general, people expect to be more on the sweet end of the spectrum. Many, many mandarins and many other types of citrus hang on the tree just fine, but the quality deteriorates. They just get sweeter, milder. Some people prefer them that way. So that's absolutely fine. It has nothing to do with fertilizer. You just need to know for each type of citrus, what is the peak period? What's the range? And be aware that some varieties hold on the tree well past their peak of perfection. Some of the ones that I planted in our mandarin orchard here, like Pixie will hang on the tree year round. You can go out there and pick a Pixie off your mandarin tree anytime you want one. And they're sweet and mild and pleasant. That's basically the way that that particular variety is always described. So it's really a matter of expectation here, but the time of harvest was probably the biggest factor.
So if you have a Satsuma tree and you have lots of mandarins on it, mm-hmm. then maybe you could go out and in November, pick one, and then a week later, pick one until it tastes right.
That would be a very good way to do it. Yes. I mean, commercially, they carry spectrophotometers that are a little pocket device where they can just take some juice and measure the soluble solids content. Soluble solids primarily being the sweet components, the sucrose, fructose, whatever. And so they know you've reached this magic number. We can harvest. In fact, there are industry standards for every type of citrus for when you can start harvesting because the skin color isn't a good guide. They will color the peel color will precede the flavor by as much as 3 to 4 weeks. And if you just went by, and they don't get much better off the tree. This is the biggest problem. They're not a climacteric fruit, technically. So you can't pick one and let it sit and it'll get sweeter. No, they typically don't get much sweeter. A little bit sweeter, yes, but not much. So you need to have them at the just the right sugar content before you can harvest. It still increases. So navel oranges picked early will not be as sweet as navel oranges picked a little bit later, but they might have a better acid balance. So yes, sampling is your very best way to do it as a home gardener. Once it turns color, start picking them. My kids would eat them tart, so fine. You can pick them in November if you want to. But we found here where we don't really get our chilling to cause the flavor profile to change until mid to late December, Christmas was our time for picking mandarins, whereas, as I say, uphill a little bit where they chill earlier, November is fine. If you're listening in Southern California, you'll just need to sample. It's very interesting to me to go to the UC Riverside Citrus Collection website, which is a massive amount of information. If you're interested in it, just type UC Riverside Citrus. The Give Out and Collection down there at Riverside is extensive, and they have uploaded tasting and sampling data from 100 years ago. I mean, everything they could find from citrus industry publications has been uploaded to that site. And I'll be looking at, wow, Riverside, they're really picking this in November? That seems unusual to me. We don't pick that until December. So there are regional variations as to when you're going to reach peak harvest stage. That's something to be aware of. If you're listening to me in Southern California, your mandarin may be sweeter earlier or more likely later in Southern California.
Well, another question from the same client. Their raspberry plants are growing and flowering, yep. but the fruit isn't developing properly. And they wondered if you had a special plant food for that raspberry.
Once again, plant food doesn't increase fruit or anything like that. The plant food is mainly for growth. And so there's no special fertilizer for that. Raspberries in the valley drive me crazy. I've tried 6 or 7 different varieties. I've grown them in the sun. I've grown them in the shade. I've grown them in containers. I've grown them in the ground. They grow just great. They spread freely. That part is no problem. As long as you get plenty of water, raspberries are very easy to grow here. And they've all had the exact same pattern. They grow and they flower in the spring like they're supposed to, and the fruit sets, and then we hit 90 degrees as the fruit is in the expansion phase and it doesn't develop properly. And I've seen pest problems that cause that, but more commonly it's simply temperature related and humidity related. I just don't think that raspberries are a successful thing in the interior of California. Every now and then I'll talk to a customer who says, oh, I have great results. And I think to myself, one, are we sure these are raspberries? Because sometimes people are confused. And please define great results. You know, do you have a great big patch that you can get a handful of fruit out of? Or do you literally get bowls and bowls of raspberries as you might expect? They're just more of a milder climate in terms of they don't care about winter temperatures. Obviously, they're very cold hardy, but the dry heat that we get here just really adversely affects raspberries. Blackberries, boysenberries, loganberries, all that kind of thing, do just fine. In fact, they take over your yard and they produce bowls and bowls of fruit, more than you could possibly use in a well-established planting. Raspberries, I just haven't done well with. If you go to extension publications, they'll always mention a couple of varieties that are said to be more heat tolerant. Oregon 1020, I think, is one of them. And the baba berry is another. they're not in the trade. I mean, they haven't been for years. I don't know of any growers that are doing them. Every now and then someone will tell me they have them, in which case, try them. We did sell the baba berry when it came on the market in the 1980s and 90s. They did grow. They did produce. They were kind of a dry style of raspberry, so there wasn't anything really exciting about them, and they just fell out of the trade for a bunch of reasons. If you have done well with raspberries anywhere in the interior of California, send us your secrets, davisgardenshow@gmail.com. I believe they'll probably involve lots of compost, manure, and a lot of water. But if you've got a variety that's done very well, we'd love to hear about it. What I always end up telling people is there is a cross between the blackberry and the raspberry that was done years ago. I believe it was done in Scotland. And the tayberry was one of the products of that. The other is the loganberry. The loganberry is more like a blackberry. The tayberry is more like a raspberry. And the tayberry does grow well in the interior and does fruit reasonably well here. So if you want a raspberry style of fruit, get the tayberry. If you like that flavor, the slightly sweeter, muskier flavor that the raspberry provides, but you want something more reliable, get a loganberry and handle it just like you would a blackberry or a boysenberry. Both can be, you know, tayberries are kind of hard to find, but a lot of nurseries do carry them in the bare root season. Loganberries you can find at a lot of nurseries, and they do quite well here.
I want to ask a question, but I'm not sure we have time for it. So okay. We'll ask it and you can cut it out if we don't have time.
Okay.
If I had raspberries and blackberries together,
yep,
and they cross-pollinated,
they can, yeah.
Would the fruit be like the parent or would the fruit be a cross?
The fruit is not affected by the hybridization. Okay. There are very few cases where what pollen is put on the flower affects the fruit. There is one important case.
Corn,
yes. So that's very important that you know that. So we'll come back to that in a moment. But no, the fruit will be what you planted. It doesn't matter what
that's pollen. That's all I needed to know. Thank you very much.
As for corn, there's a funny discussion going on at our household here because one was going to plant sweet corn. One said they wanted me to plant popcorn.
Uh-oh.
Well, they better be on different parts of the property. That's all I can say. You'll have very chewy sweet corn or very unpoppable popcorn. So we're going to make this work. But I just to answer the follow-up question, how far apart do they need to be? 500 feet is the answer I found online and in other places.
Okay, so this same customer, boy, this customer had a lot of questions, had aphids on their plum tree and was wondering if neem spray would work to solve that problem.
It might, but you don't really need to solve that problem. Every year we plant, we get aphids on plums. It's a particular aphid, the black aphid that gets on there. It's on the underside of the leaf, about a foot of the new growth in the spring, usually starting in late March, early April. The leaves are all curled up. People think they have peach leaf curl. They come in, I have peach leaf curl on my plum, and I just take the leaf and I open it up and show them what they really have. And invariably, when I open it up, you can look and you'll see a bunch of black aphids and some that are bloated, tan, and listless. They've been parasitized. There are natural predators, parasitic wasps that will go after the black aphid on plums and do a very good job of controlling them. So while I get them on my plums and pluots every year, about a foot of growth is affected. Then the growth starts coming out unaffected. And I know that basically the population is being managed naturally. The only case where you wouldn't have that happening is if you are routinely spraying your plum tree for other pests. So those of you listening where you have plum curculio and other pests like that, where you have to spray every couple weeks through the growing season, you are going to have to spray for aphids as well, because you'll be killing the beneficials and the aphids will keep rebounding. So that'll be part of what you're spraying for. It's a lot harder to grow fruit trees back east than it is here. I'll just say that. If you're moving out to California, one of the big benefits of moving to the Sacramento Valley is that all these fruit trees you're having to spray all the time, you don't have to do that here. But if in the valley here, the aphids show up, the aphids are bad for a little while, the leaves are distorted, the fruit is unaffected, it doesn't affect the blossoms at all, and then they just outgrow it. Neem would probably work, but the thing is that the aphids are on the underside of the leaf and they're curling the leaf around them. So you'd have to get in there and spray in such a way that oils like neem work by smothering. So it has to smother them. It has to be on them. So spraying it on the top of the leaf doesn't do anything. Spraying it has to be on the underside of the leaf, which is a challenge when the leaf is curled around the aphids. I don't know how you would effectively spray neem, and I don't think it's necessary. And this is important to note, since neem is very popular with organic gardeners especially, it does have some effects on beneficial insects. I mean, it acts as a repellent. Part of the way neem works is by repelling insects. So you think that parasitic wasps are not going to be repelled by it? I don't have a lot of data on that subject. I wouldn't assume that they are not. So it could be making things, honestly, a little worse in the long run. Just let things run their course. Integrated pest management, key principle, identify your pest, done. Monitor. Monitor the population. If the population plateaus and then seems to be decreasing, evidenced by new growth unaffected, you don't need to worry about it.
So with the aphids that are on a plum, if you could physically get to them, which is at the top of the tree, you can't really, but if you could they just be wiped off with a tissue or rinsed off with water, or are they
Well,
firmly attached?
these black aphids are pretty firmly on there. The aphids you get on your peaches and your roses, you can blast them off. They're right up top where you can't miss them. They're out in the open. They're pretty easy to control. These, I think you'd have to take a pressure washer and you'd have to just like blast like crazy. It might be a good way to thin your plums a little bit. I'm sure it would knock some of the fruit off. And if you've got, by the way, if you've got scale up there, that's a great way to manage them anyway. So it's worth a try. But overall, this is a problem that typically runs its course. Every aphid that I'm aware of, and I've looked up a ton of them, has a particular temperature range in which it reproduces at its peak. And then above that temperature range, it doesn't reproduce as well. And in the case of the aphids that are, so they typically are a 4 to 6 week problem at most in our climate. There are places where the temperature never gets high enough to stop the problem, but here it does. And so they're typically, like most pest problems, a 4 to 6 week problem, and the plant outgrows it. And again, no effect on the fruit. So no particular reason to worry about at least that aspect of it. I understand it looks bad because leaves are all curled up, but it's just going to run its course. Learning what parasitized aphids look like can be a very positive experience because then almost anytime you're looking at a collection of aphids, you can evaluate whether or not this problem is going to solve itself. We have lots of beneficials, and I'm not just talking about things like ladybugs and leatherwing beetles and lacewings that feed directly on aphids. I'm talking about the parasitic wasps, which ultimately can give even better long-term control in your garden. You almost never see these little wasps. They are maybe a quarter inch, and I've seen them. I've seen them coming in and ovipositing. I've seen ants trying to kill them. Ants are trying to protect the aphids. All that's going on in your garden, basically, without your knowing it. But in the long run, I guarantee the parasitic wasps will win.
So after all these questions that this customer had and Don very carefully answered, his final comment was he talked them out of all of those things and sold them some flowers instead.
Yeah, plant some flowers. There you go. I would much rather sell you a flowering plant than a pesticide any day. Okay. But people looking for fertilizers, people looking for pest control products. I went to a retail seminar very early on in my career where the comment was made when they have a problem, when they walk into your store with a problem, they should walk out with a product. No, they should walk out with information and some flowers. That's my philosophy.
We are going to end our show with a garden quote, and this is from that lovely book, The Gardener Says. I like this one. I'm going to modify just slightly. Come in from the garden at the end of the day, you should smell like dirt.
You should, first of all, never call it dirt. You should smell like soil. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
That's Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.